Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new The Hacker Factory podcast with hacker maker Philip Wiley. You're about to discover what the role of a professional hacker entails, the different specializations it holds, and what it takes to learn and become one. Enjoy the conversation as Philip and guests unveil the secrets of professional hacking, a mysterious, intriguing, and often misunderstood occupation. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to another episode of the Hacker Factory podcast. I'm your host, Philip Wiley, and today I've got Greg Porterfeld joining me today. So Greg and I have known each other for a little while. We got to meet during DEF CON last year, and he works with some other friends at Set Solutions. And so I thought we just recently was kind of thinking about guests to have on and thought Greg would be a good one. So welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you for having me. It's quite an honor to be here.
That's great to have you here. Most of the listeners are trying to get into cybersecurity, so these stories are very helpful on helping others get started. So I'm sure you'll have some great advice that will be helpful to some people trying to either get started or maybe move into other areas of cybersecurity.
Absolutely, I hope so. My path here was kind of different, so it'll be fun to talk about.
Sure. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and kind of share your path into cybersecurity?
So my path to cybersecurity has kind of been over the last 20 years. I started coming out of school. I was a developer. I moved into operations and did system administration for a long time. And one of the things that I've kind of been doing was through each role, I am kind of always learning something new and usually kind of stretching that role. So from my first development job doing application and support, which was now 15, 20 years ago, learning how to not only build and support our applications, but then how to deploy them and run our data centers. And that was kind of interesting, watching a small SaaS product grow from, you know, it was two servers, it lived in a little tiny data center, and it was just kind of a local thing. And over time, we started growing that into a larger and larger environment, and there was more to keeping the system alive and secure in some cases than building the code. So I started moving more towards that. And after some years and a couple of acquisitions, I ended up moving out to Florida for that job and kind of started taking a more direct, just the system administration part and dropped the development, was still kind of reviewing that progress, but started expanding the portfolio into just running servers and building out larger infrastructures, working with the cloud and things like that. When I left that place, I went to work for a kind of large auto retailer, and my kind of role there was an application support, but it was not a very busy job. So I started getting into writing scripts, starting with PowerShell and then eventually moving on to Python to do a little bit of kind of the early versions of log parsing and threat analysis. This was before we had things like Splunk in the environment and things like that. I was doing it more or less kind of by hand of taking those event logs, trying to rip out events of why is this person logging in or where are they logging in from. And that kind of accidentally led to being tied into the when we did buy Splunk, there was a meeting about, hey, we need to deploy this thing. So I was just there to basically support the application. And I ended up owning the whole thing. The team that was building it didn't actually want to own it. So I started running Splunk and learning how to do that. That got me exposed to a lot of kind of data ingestion, monitoring, how do we do observability, and also starting to get connected with our security team, which was being built out. So as they were a customer trying to use those logs, how do we find this, that, or the other type of event or this thing is going on? And over the next couple of years, I would certify and do lots of things with Splunk and went to a couple of different organizations and kind of bigger and bigger environments, getting closer and closer to security. But when it was time to leave that organization, I got a call from a recruiter and they're like, hey, you want to come to Texas and do Splunk consulting work for us? And my first thought was, no, I really don't want to go to Texas. I was hoping to go back home to Colorado. But ended up taking the role, came here to Texas, and started doing more interesting Splunk work very close to the security teams, and started realizing that while Splunk is a cool operational tool, the idea of SIEM and how that ties and all of that observability information, it got me to the point where I was sitting next to the security people and I was trying to build detections for, you know, whether the application was being attacked or the infrastructure was being compromised or anything like that. I was trying to find sample data for things that were going on, like a SQL injection was the one that started it. And I was looking for what that would look like in a particular log file. I couldn't find what I really wanted. And I had this idea of I should just learn how to do the attacks so that I could capture all that data. And that ended up being really kind of interesting. It led me down a path of hacking was something that I was doing for a different end. I was kind of afraid of the idea of attacking other people's systems, or, you know, kind of even in a controlled environment, I didn't really want to break stuff. I had spent my career building and securing things, or at least protecting them to keep them up. The switching over to the other side and doing attacks seemed challenging. Anyway, some time would go by and SET was doing a CTF, which we do every year, and they had opened it up to the internal team to test. And this would be a very kind of interesting thing. I went into the CTF. It was my very first one. And my goal for that was just not come in last place. It was, you know, 10 or 15 of the local engineers here in the company. And I just didn't want to be last. I wanted to answer one question, get it right, and just not be in last place. And I ended up being almost the winner. I had the lead for a while and then someone came in at the end and beat me, but I did better than I thought I would. And that started a lot of gears turning. And over the next couple of years, this puts us into where COVID and the pandemic were. I spent a lot of time doing CTFs and try hack me, hack the box, pretty much any of the ranges I could get my hands on, and just started learning how to do kind of offensive security or pen testing as it was. And at the end of about a year and a half, we needed a pen tester for a task. And my boss asked if I would be willing to do that pen test. It was an external. And I was like, well, if, you know, someone else is supporting me, I'm not quite sure I'm ready for this. But as long as someone else is kind of sitting with me to kind of help or make sure I'm not missing anything, it would be a good place to start. And over that test was kind of interesting. And then for the last year and a half, I have been doing pen testing almost full time, still continuing to learn and do everything that I do. But I took a very strange path to get here, but now I'm a pen tester.
Yeah, but with that background you got, I'm sure I can see so many advantages to things there because, you know, having the sysadmin background, because, you know, some people nowadays, you know, because why, you know, kind of like yourself, I started out as in other areas. I started out as a sysadmin and, you know, you kind of go through these other areas and learn it, you know, learn these different skills to a decent degree that helps you through pen testing. But some people are just jumping right in learning pen testing and they may miss some things that they don't study hard enough or, you know, focus on some of those other areas, but just kind of seeing your background, I can see why you got into pen testing and why you make a good pen tester.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting having all of those past experiences to leverage of seeing how to build or working on building and deploying applications makes it easier to understand when we are attacking them of these things are going to show up. There's going to be these types of things to look for. And it just, I think, adds a little something. I don't think it's necessarily required to be coming from a development or operations background, but it certainly does help a lot.
Yeah, I would imagine. And just your experience with logs, I'm sure you can see a lot of need in using things like Wireshark or using some different packet sniffers and stuff on your pen tests.
Oh, absolutely. It makes me very paranoid too. I know what can be captured and what kind of visibility a system could have. So I'm constantly kind of like, oh, if I do this, it's going to, you know, pop an alert in their log. And I'm usually making more assumptions than there are of, while I would like to think every organization is seeing everything that we're doing, the fact of the matter is they're probably only going to see it if they go looking for it, unless they have a pretty robust program. So I've kind of learned to put that aside of don't worry about getting caught, especially as a pen tester. That's kind of my job. If we're trying to be sneaky, then we'd be sneaky. But as a application or a external pen test, you kind of want them to see that. You want them to be like, hey, we saw you doing this, that, and the other thing. It's like, cool. That's really good.
Yeah, very interesting. It's interesting sometimes to be on some pen tests when it's not one of these deals where you're trying to go undetected, but you don't get detected, or if you're supposed to be trying to be quiet and get missed out. Because it's amazing so much of the noise sometimes in environments that you can be doing things and they totally get missed out on.
Yes. Yeah, most of our tools are very loud. But that's okay. Like if they find it, that's good. If they don't see it, it's an opportunity for them to think about how that might impact them, especially when you have an exposed application or something like that, of you should have seen this coming, or you should have been able to detect that we did this, that, or the other. And we usually do call that out of, if you didn't see us brute forcing your login page, we have a problem.
Very cool. So, just out of curiosity, I know since you came from a background of doing some development stuff, would you advise someone if they're wanting to get started in cybersecurity, would you encourage someone to learn scripting or some type of coding?
I would encourage it, but it's not a requirement. I don't think there's very many skills that can't be brought to a useful place from a offensive or pen testing perspective. And knowing how to write code will speed some things up. You can automate tools, or you know what to do if a tool isn't configured for a particular application or something is getting in your way. We now have companies and organizations or tools that are able to block, you know, whether it's SQL map or burp scanner, whatever, knowing how to automate a browser with Python and Selenium can get you past some of those hops. But there's usually more than one way to approach it. I know pen testers who are great with code. I know pen testers who don't write code. I don't think it makes you better if you know how to. I just think you have different tools in the box. So from a perspective of, do you need to do it? No. But I personally think coding makes me a better pen tester.
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear people's point of views on that, because I had Alyssa Knight on, and Alyssa Knight doesn't know how to code, which really kind of surprised me, some of the things she's done, you know, because you see some of the people, like you said, you can do it without having to know how to code, but then you see some of the people that are writing tools and doing some pretty amazing stuff. And it just kind of surprised me with the things that she's done that she didn't know how to code. So it's, for people listening, it's good. I do like the way you put it, because some people that have been in the industry for a while, sometimes they kind of, things are pretty much cut and dry. They say you have to do this, or you have to do that. But I like the way that you kind of leave it up to the person if they want to do that. And it's not necessarily required, because a lot of people get scared off sometimes, or either they think, I got to learn Python first before I learn a pen test. Mm-hmm. And then they spend all this time learning Python, and maybe they get discouraged with that and then just totally give up on learning how to pen test.
I think that it's one of the things that I've experienced over the years is the programming kind of concept hasn't really changed a whole lot, but the languages do all the time. Python went through an interesting one of, you have Python 2 versus Python 3. So most of the better tools when I was getting started, we were right in the middle of the migration of what was Python 2 versus what was Python 3. And certain things didn't work in certain places. And that was interesting. But if a person coming into cybersecurity, or if a person has any curiosity about IT at all, there aren't a whole lot of functions anymore where having scripting in your tool belt isn't going to be beneficial to you. I think there are lots of places where, especially with the way machine learning and the AIs are going are what makes us good as humans doing jobs is the ability to adapt and kind of control whether it's tools or things like that. With everything being automated, we need to be able to move faster and do more things. The scope of a pen test, when you're touching an application, there's hundreds of things that we should be looking for. If you want to do deep coverage, you really have to get into automation. But you can spend time writing code in Python. You can also pick up tools like Nuclei or Burps Scanner with various plugins and approach that without ever writing code. So I try and when people ask me, how do I start being a pen tester? Do I need to write code? I would encourage them if they're inclined to do it. You know, if coding seems like something that's interesting, absolutely chase that down, because it's going to be something that's going to help you. If they're adverse to code, that's okay. Let's talk about tools. Let's talk about, you know, how would you approach this kind of a problem? But also, why are you afraid of code? What is it about it? Is it the setup? Is it this, that, or the other? And see if there's something they didn't know about. Writing code can get you started pretty fast. So if there's not a block, let's try and get through them.
Yeah, just kind of the benefits of coding too, be able to reverse engineer things and can be very helpful.
Yes. Reversing is a completely skill. It's one that I'm still building. But having the ability to read code in general definitely has its advantages in so many places. Even reading exploits of what is this thing going to do, or this exploit didn't work because the way that tool designer or that exploit developer wrote it, it's not compatible with this. But if you understand what it's doing, then you can tweak that code and make it work for your environment so you increase your likelihood for success.
So you mentioned automation and AI. So have you been playing around with any AI?
I have been messing with ChatGPT over the last, you know, about month and a half that we've had that toy to play with. I have been trying to use it, and I've found that as I think the consensus is drawing to, ChatGPT is an interesting tool, but it's right now pretty close to being a toy. It can provide inspiration. If you don't quite know what to do, or if you're looking for how to start something, you can ask it a bunch of questions and it will give you decent enough answers. I was doing this with a project that I just started a couple of weeks ago of, I picked a new framework and a new language model and was trying to decide, you know, in this case, it was, you know, React, Angular versus Vue.js, trying to understand what those three different things were. I have some experience with React. I don't know Angular, but I ended up deciding to use Vue based off what ChatGPT told me. And I haven't really regretted that decision. Most of the code that it gave me an idea of what it's supposed to look like, but it didn't work. But that's not unusual. I've asked it for Python, give me a simple scraper. It does that about 98% accurate, which was fine. It's enough that if you have a fundamental, ChatGPT will get you a little bit quicker. If you don't have the fundamental, it's going to probably break things faster. It's going to be harder to get started because you don't know when it's wrong. But the conversational stuff, having it help me phrase findings in some case of, I can write a, you know, quick description of a vulnerability and it can help me flesh that out a little bit. That was fun to play with. I usually don't use what it says. I just take it and like, oh, okay, that's a different approach. And I rewrite my thought about it. But it has been interesting to work with.
Yeah, it's always interesting to hear someone that's used it or a good educated guess, you know, educated experience from someone using it, because you see a lot of people that are more of a, from a writing background, that they write about it, what they predict, they think, you know, just so worried about the risk and that it's taking over and stuff, but they don't really think about it. I mean, it's just like malware tech has had some interesting conversations that he's posted on LinkedIn and Twitter. It's kind of interesting to see. And I think one of the best quotes I've seen is that your job won't be replaced by someone, won't be replaced by AI, it'd be replaced by someone using AI.
Yes.
Because it definitely seems like you have to know something about what you're trying to do with AI, you know, like you mentioned, some of the code not working whenever you try to get ChatGPT to generate it.
Mm-hmm. I agree with the, it's going to be something that we're going to have to learn to integrate. Watching the offensive security people and you know, InfoSec Twitter and all of these things, when ChatGPT dropped, there were the kind of initial responses of, oh, this thing is fabulous. Because you give it a prompt and it gives you a, you know, an essay. And then as we spent more time looking at it, we started picking apart like its inability to do math. It doesn't understand, you know, simple examples. It failed to do 4 + 4 and it got the wrong answer, then argued about getting the wrong answer. But the part about ChatGPT that it's meant to be used for, that conversational AI, is solid. Humans are just as fallible. We say the things that are incorrect all the time. So I'm not so much worried about it, its ability to do facts, but I was surprised by the side effect of it can write code. It can spit out Python code better than I can, for the most part, because I don't dry run Python. I write my code, test it, it fails. I, you know, make my fixes and then it starts working again. So the fact that it could write Python at all was interesting to me. I think over the next few years, we will see more and more of that. Some parts of different jobs will be assisted by AIs. Some parts will be taken over entirely. The AI that can do defense protection type functions, we already have those tools in the world. Of they're watching all the logs, they're understanding what normal looks like, and they see something and respond because this is what they thought. Now we're starting to see the tools that have, the offensive tools that are powered by machine learning and AI, they're starting to creep in. Threat actors aren't really using them, but individuals are. And when we start putting those two sides together, I think it's going to be a very interesting world to live in.
Yeah, I agree. It just kind of makes you wonder what the next evolution of like Metasploit or some of these vulnerability scanners, how it's going to enhance those tools.
Oh, absolutely. Like the possibilities are kind of endless. It's just, will we get accurate models that are any better than, you know, will we see an AI scanner that can take like what Burp scanners does to find and detect things, but do it on a very low and slow or very quiet way where it's not going to, you know, anger the WAF the moment it gets started, and just kind of mix things up a little bit to kind of emulate how humans would work through an application, but just slip in a test or an exploit every once in a while without confusing it. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, I agree. So as far as someone wanting to get started in pen testing, what would you recommend the path they take to learn how to pen test?
First, they should probably do what I did and read your book. The Pen Tester Blueprint was a very good start for what to expect from this field. And I've had a few of those conversations of how do I get into pen testing? And I think the first question should always be, do you actually want to be a pen tester? Because there's lots of different parts of information security. Even from the offensive side, we have pen testers, we have application pen testers, the internal, external sides, we have red teaming and purple teaming. They're all very distinct from each other. Some of the skill sets work together, but I, like myself, I do not like social engineering, and I'm not super fond of doing like internal pen tests. They make me uncomfortable, and I just don't like them. So I don't. On the other side, I love doing application pen tests and external pen tests and those kind of things that usually I can work in a safer environment. I don't have to worry about breaking something. And I'm not trying to like compromise people. It makes me uncomfortable to do like phishing exercises because I just don't like manipulating people that way. But manipulating a server doesn't bother me, so I don't have any challenges there. Red teaming is an interesting perspective of offensive security because we have you're trying to enable the blue team to be better. You're trying to get the defensive side to solve other interesting problems. And when they can learn together, that's always fun to watch as well. And Purple bringing all together. But my first usual question is, what do you really like? What parts of this interest you? Is it hacking and banging on things? Because that can be fun. Or are you trying to do it with more of a purpose? And try to get folks to understand how wide this field is. A generic pen tester is very, very busy, but someone who focuses on mobile or focuses on web or other types of applications or the network side, figuring out what they want to do is always the first step. And if they don't know, well, now it's time to talk about CTFs, because we can expose people to different kinds of challenges and let them play games to get the serotonin boost or whatever might be interesting. Of CTFs are a great way to get started here, because you can get exposed to everything without years and years of commitment. Try HackMe was incredibly useful to me to filter out the stuff that I wanted to do and the stuff that I don't want to do. It also, you know, a lot of CTFs, Hack the Box's Cyber Apocalypse, which is coming up soon, has a wide array of challenges, from reversing to traditional, just, you know, own the box or whatever. And those are really good ways to sort out what to do. So with that out of the way, the next step is how to learn how to do this stuff. And like coding, I don't think there's any one path, but I do think there are different paths that are appropriate for different folks. Whether it's traditional education, going to school, pursuing certifications, whether that's the, you know, OSCP or the Cyber Mentors PMPT type things, or Udemy. I mean, there's so many different ways for us to learn. And most of them can be low cost. YouTube is free, sort of. And finding courses that are like what Heath and the Cyber Mentor have been doing, with $20 to $30 courses that will get you prepped for a pen test. It's not going to tell you every detail, but it's going to get you ready to go, or at least ready to start that from an entry level. Those are all wonderful resources that are pretty approachable for most people. And then from like with that kind of model, or however is most effective for that person to learn, just start finding ways to practice. Those cyber ranges are free. People who are trying to get into hacking today don't have to hack other people's stuff and risk jail to learn. We now have pretty much free and legal ways to do everything. So try new things, try and see what you can do with this. And I think letting people find their path, but helping them figure out what their end goal should be is probably the how I approach it.
That's some good advice too. And one of the things too, for anyone listening that not sure what area of cybersecurity they want to go into, you don't even have to go into the offensive side to do cool things like threat hunting and incident response are some pretty cool areas to work in. It's just amazing how the field has expanded so much, because, you know, 20 plus years ago, you didn't have all these different options on a security team. You know, it was very limited to what you got to do. And now there's so many different things out there to do.
Absolutely.
So we're getting down towards the end of the show. Is there any advice that you'd like to share that maybe you didn't speak to yet?
I think for people who are trying to get in, one tip kind of from where this career always leads is learn to love logging, or not logging, but note-taking and reporting. Almost every position in this, especially in the offensive side, is going to lead to a report. We don't get paid to hack. We get paid to write a report about what we did. And it has to be understandable by people who don't know how to hack. One of the best things that I was told when I was getting started was start taking notes immediately, whether it's the Try HackMe room or Hack the Box, or if you're just doing, you know, PortSwigger Academy Labs, whatever, take notes, document that process, because the more of them you do, the harder it will be to remember how to approach a particular type of vulnerability. You've seen it 6 months ago, but you don't quite remember. If you're good at taking your notes, you can reference that a lot faster. And a lot of folks out there talk about, do the write-ups. Write up what you're doing, not only to yourself, but get practice writing how you approached a challenge, so that when it does come time to write the report, it's not difficult or it's not a foreign process. OSCP does do a nice job of forcing that report. You don't pass the OSCP until you write a report. And I think that's good. And many other of the certifications are focusing on that as well. So, learn to get into note-taking and reporting early, just to help set up those rhythms and figure out what tools you like working with and which ones you don't.
Great advice. Well, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to join. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you on the next episode.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hacker Factory podcast with Philip Wiley. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.